So that was incest. No, is that where we stopped, incest? Before I meditate, did I read that? I don't remember what I did.
The last was a 186.
Oh, all right, okay, I did do that, yeah. Bringing to perfection. The human body is concealed, that's okay.
Yep.
Just finding the spirit in the matter.
Did that.
She goes into, on page 188, the Gnostic myth that Sophia is fallen into matter.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that. That's just expressing the same things we've been talking about in a different idiom, in a Gnostic idiom.
Well, well.
I think that's, you know, that is the main stuff. Starting on the idea of bringing to perfection, bringing matter to perfection. She mentions again concupiscencia, that was there in page 191, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines down. Just the same ideas. Maybe I just will mention that a quick Gnostic myth was that Helen, remember Helen of Troy?
Mm-hmm.
In a Gnostic myth, Simon Magus was discovered Sophia in the form of Helen in a brothel in Tyre. That's the myth. She's talking about 190 to 191. So the idea is there that Sophia falls down to a low state, and she's experienced as the Helen of Troy, namely through eroticism. So same idea. Just a myth that describes what we've been talking about in with the same message, but in different language. The last point in this chapter, I call under point 14 in study guide, page 3, is the inner experience of the numinous. And that is simply that the encounter with Sophia is numinous. Or, if you wanted to use different language, emotionally powerful. Instinctually powerful. This is the kind of emotional, physical experience that shakes you. And that takes us over to 194.
I have a question.
Yeah.
On page 193, where it says that the in psychological language, the individual field of consciousness is, on that next line, a four-function structure.
That's the typology.
Oh, that's, okay.
Summing up, 194, second paragraph, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines. Wisdom appears on the one hand as the divine truth inspiring the alchemist, and on the other hand as a datum of physical nature. That would be the desire or the synchronicity, which needs to be processed and perfected by the opus. Which means you have to take that experience and work on it until you understand its meaning. She contains all the attributes of divinity and is the highest and lowest at once. That's what we've been trying to drive home. And of course, it's the lowest that's so threatening to us. A bringer of enlightenment, the psychopomp to God, and a secret hidden in matter, the unconscious, which, and we've talked about that as desire and synchronicity, which can be freed only by extraction, by conscious realization. Uh, The effect which the invasion of this archetypal image had upon the author seems at first to have been one bordering on exaltation. So we're not going to dwell on that at the moment, how it affected him, but when we get to part two, then we'll see how it affected him. And the different, sometimes it puts him up, sometimes it puts him down, what he goes through to try to realize it. Questions? Again, I'm going to move along because we've got the main idea, and these next couple of chapters just represent Sophia in different ways. What happens in chapter two, I think, is best summed up on page 197. What the science is and how she cometh into being. I, that's the key word there, I will lay bare. So what the first experience of her does is it produces egotism. Produces egotism. You get all excited about the experience. And the less you understand it, the more you'll talk about it. And you'll talk about it in a way that makes you seem special for having it. That's the whole point of chapter two. As she says there on 195, an ego-toned trait, see where I am, the third line after the quote, an ego-toned trait even appears. I will reveal the truth. And he addresses himself only to kings and learned men. This is a guy who's terrified of women. But he acts like he's got the truth, rather than saying a piece of truth has broken in on me and how in the world am I ever going to assimilate it. You do get the counterpole to that in the same quote on 197, that it is... she is seen as a sacrament. So you're going to see him going between both poles. Between being elated, being depressed, and seeing that this is something to serve. So you get the same thing in the 197, the second quote. I bring the knowledge. That's pretty much I think that's the gist of chapter two. I don't see any point dwelling on these things. You've heard them already, just to give you the main idea.
But it's such good reading.
Well, look what we've got to go through.
I know.
Could that also be said it starts with the inflation?
Yeah.
They're not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah, they are.
Egos are always behind the inflation.
Yeah. Yeah, This experience hits us, hits somebody, and we first identify with it. And we think because we've had the experience that we've assimilated it. And we begin very quickly beginning to proselytize. You judge other people from the basis of the experience, and you don't realize where you stack up vis-a-vis the experience. And sure enough, you see in the next chapter, chapter 3, it's a polemic against fools who don't understand this. He's terrified by it, but he goes on about fools who don't understand. Now, this is very typical for when a unconscious content emerges, in our language, it usurps the ego. Ego identifies with it. The person behaves as if they are this experience and that they have understood this experience. The classic example, for those of you who have a masochistic character and went through the Nietzsche class, is Nietzsche. You know, he rants and raves about humanity, and he has no life. He's lonely as can be, and he's telling everybody else what's wrong with him. Classic. Inflation. It doesn't mean it's untrue. So, as she says on page 200, the third chapter, these little explanations, since in the main it is only a polemic against fools. And at the end of that paragraph, the aggressive tone points even more clearly to a trace of inflation in the author. Over on page 201, for the wise have not spoken to the foolish. In 202, she sums up. The psychic events that are expressed in these first three chapters, summing up the psychic events that are expressed in these first three chapters, we are struck most of all by the fact that the author seems to have succumbed to a certain presumptuousness, which alienates him from the ordinary man. One would have expected that the encounter with wisdom would bring about a profound religious upheaval or else a depression. We'll see that comes. That drove him back on himself. This depression does, in fact, appear in chapter 6. To begin with, however, he tries to override the experience with a kind of intellectual superficiality, to preserve his conscious standpoint by pretending that he knows what it is all about. He even unconsciously identifies with wisdom insofar as he claims to enlighten the blind by his teachings. This reaction suggests an intellectual inflation in the author, but this attitude does not last long. He genuinely tries to come to grips with the experience. And that coming to grips will be the last half of the book. Questions on it? You with me so far? Okay, we're picking up speed now until we get to maybe one or two points, but basically until we get to first parable. Second paragraph around 203, this chapter is devoted to an explanation of the title Aurora Consurgence, which is a play on the words Aurora and Aurora, golden hour, which means the dawn.
Which means what?
The dawn.
Oh, dawn.
Oh, how cute.
I think not terribly relevant to this text necessarily, but if you're involved in dream work, you've got a nice little schema of colors, which, believe it or not, appear pretty regularly in dreams. Black, red, yellow, and white. And there's no clearly fixed order. I think generally you can think black starts it off. That's the depression. That when a new orientation tries to come into your life, it destroys the old. And the loss of the old is depressing. And red would be what generally follows that. And that's the emotional intensity that gets activated as the emotions beneath that black stuff start coming up. White would be the clarity when you begin to understand what you've been through. And now coming to the languages, the negredo is the black, rubedo is the red, albedo is the white.
So what order are they again?
Well, roughly, take it with a grain of salt, black, red, white, and then yellow is the gold.
Would that be the integration?
And that would be the final stage. That would be the redeemed state. And she goes into that by virtue of the fact that the dawn is golden. It's also useful for understanding the symbolism of the East in dreams. I'm going East. Well, you're going to the area of the rising sun. Or I'm going West. I'm going in the area of the setting sun. So dreams of going East can mean preparing for a new beginning. Dreams of going West can mean preparing for the loss of something. As you know, you can't apply this one-to-one, but it's nice to know these possibilities. And then she goes into descriptions of the dawn on 204 from the theological standpoint. Basically, they're all common sense, that the East was equated with the rising Christ. She talks a little bit about now just playing on dusk and dawn. St. Augustine had the idea that there were two types of knowledge. I've heard it called morning knowledge and evening knowledge. She calls it dawn knowledge and twilight knowledge. I think morning knowledge would be knowledge of sacred things, and evening knowledge would be knowledge of worldly things. So that the rising sun, the dawn, would be knowledge of sacred things. See, she's just amplifying.
What did you say the evening knowledge is?
Knowledge of worldly things. Non-worldly and worldly. Aurora, she mentions a dawn, in other words, on page 206, that it's the light which we've talked about in the luminosity of the unconscious. Nothing new. She calls it a feminine light. Page 206, the second paragraph. That's the main points, I think, of that chapter. Maybe just, some of this is so obvious, but just to say it, that the dawn would represent the end of a depression. Again, it's amazing how this stuff appears in the dream. I just saw a dream a couple of weeks ago of a woman who came in saying, I just can't take this guy anymore. I think I'm going to file for divorce. And her dream, what do you think she dreamt of that night? It referenced this. It was the just before sunrise. And it was the darkest hour. I said, well, wait a little bit. She came back and she said, you won't believe what happened. For the first time in America, he called me up and said, how you doing? See how that thing works? And the unconscious knew it was the darkest hour and that things would get better.
And that would be synchronicity, too.
And, well, I guess you'd have to call that synchronicity. Somehow, I had thought for years, divorce that jerk. Jesus Christ, he's awful. But, the unconscious had a different knowledge that it is going to get brighter. And what you have been through is a very long night, and you are now in its darkest hour. And really, she was suicidal. She said, I don't want to live anymore.
Gary, that aspect, that almost what seems to sound like future forecasting aspect to what you described, It seems to play with time. I mean, the whole world.
It sure does.
Because it's incredible to think that something, let's call it a thing, could know in advance where you're going to wind up, let's say, in 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. All the time, I've seen it where you're going to end up in 20 years, 10 years.
How do you learn to trust it? Because it doesn't make sense. I mean,
that's what you gotta do. You gotta learn to trust in it. You gotta learn to trust in that.
You have to trust it, but you also have to critique it. Mm-hmm. You have to do both. And, you know, to me, if you just let that work, if I let that work on me, you see, it just shows us the dimensions of life. That there's something else behind the screen. And that's what this book is an attempt to grasp. I saw that, a tragic example of that I saw when I very first moved here. I don't know if I mentioned this to you or not ever, but a guy came in, and really, I really dislike people in my practice. I dislike this guy. And he was a preacher. And just slick, lying, what was the word for Elmer Gantry? And his first dream was that he was walking down a road and came to a fork in the road. And off to the right, he and his wife were together. Off to the left, she was being loaded into a bubble and carried up to heaven. Did I tell you this? No. Loaded into a bubble and being carried up to heaven. And I said to him, I don't know what this means, but it's serious, buddy. And you better get your act together. This guy was so bad. I mean, I don't think I've, in 20 years, I don't think I've ever been ripped off. Except maybe by him, financially. I demanded a cashier's check in my hand 24 hours in advance of an hour before I'd see him. He was that sleazy. And he and his wife were co-pastoring that church. And I said, I don't know what is going to happen, but you better wake up or something bad's going to happen. That's all I can tell you. Well, 2 years later, he came in. His wife, she was about 40 at that time. He woke up one morning and she was in the bed next to him, dead. 40 years old. See, that dream knew that years in advance. It's just, you just have to say, holy smokes. Yeah. And so this sense that there's this other dimension of time, you could say, which is why we did number N time. Mm-hmm. There's some other givenness, and we're the players. There's another story somewhere, and we're the players. Now, you can take that fatalistically and just say, oh, well, it's not quite like that, because we do have some ability to change things.
He had a fork in the road.
But in a sense, this woman, I think there you can see it's almost eerie that the unconscious knew this thing is going to get better. I don't know whether they're going to make it or not, but he's trying. It may be too late. He's begun to try. And the unconscious knew he's going to begin to try. So there's this sense of a fatedness, of a patternness, which is not something we do. And yet there's this other sense that we do have control. So that's very relevant to Sophia, because Sophia is this otherness of some dimension where events are happening that our ego is just the actor for. And yet, on another hand, we do have something to say about her, because her relationship to life is dependent on us. That's what these people keep saying. You know, it's we perfect her. So it's this, if you can maybe have a feeling for this material, it will help you read this book, which at times gets a little abstract. But it's this sense that there's a mystery, that we really try to start with the mystery and have a relationship to it. And how do you do that? How do you act responsibly and also receptively? And what's the nature of the mystery? And what's it asking of us? What can we ask of it? And so on. And that a completely lived life is lived in relationship to this other, capital O. Yeah.
Is that
sort of
what they call appropriation?
Oh. I think this is what Matthew Fox is trying to drive at, personally, as I understand it. Yeah. Right. There is a divine reality and there is a human reality, and they are of equal importance. I say divine because that's traditional language. Jung would say a non-ego reality, an a priori non-ego reality. Yeah. So there is an emotional reason to this book, and that is to try to understand this. And then as therapist, how do we help bring people to that? Okay, chapter 5. What he does now is try to describe in ecclesiastical language what he's just experienced. So he will say, oh, that is what the church describes as. Why does he do that? It's an attempt to disidentify from the experience. That, of course, has a positive and a negative effect. Positive in that it keeps away inflation. Negative is that it spares you the confrontation. Right. Well, let me see if I can bring it down to earth a little bit. When I discuss this stuff publicly, somebody will say, well, isn't Christ what Jung calls the self? Well, is it? In a way it is, and in a way it isn't. To be a purist, I would say that there is a certain experience that human beings have had, and they give it a picture, and that picture is Christ, and the church then embodies that picture. So when you go to church, you can get close to that experience because the church embodies the image of that experience. So if you have a dream of Christ, now this is not that you know you're doing this, but you can have a dream of a Christ-like figure, and you go to church, you feel like you are in contact with that dream image. And it gives you a good feeling because you're resonating outwardly with what is inside you. That has been the positive function of the church, that it puts as on a panoramic screen all our inner experiences. So I don't have to have my experiences. I get my experiences by being there. Or it feels almost like I'm having my experiences by being there. Does this make sense?
And relating this back to when we did the Grail study, we talked about the fact that ultimately what we did is we concretized Christ. We put this image outside of ourselves.
I'm saying that in a different way.
Rather than actually recognizing that it was an internal experience.
Yeah, that's another way of saying what I'm saying. I'm just trying to develop a little bit further to show the positive side of that.
Right.
Positive, quote unquote.
But it can also keep you on the ship.
But it keeps you from the individual experience. Let's take maybe a somewhat silly and hypothetical example of a addict who is self-centered, not concerned about their effect on other people's feelings, dishonestly gainful. When they go to church, and they have a feeling they want to draw now to close to a different experience, and they go to church and they have an experience of Christ. Christ will say to them, well, you shouldn't be this, you shouldn't be this, you shouldn't be this, you should be this, you should be this, you should be this, and I will love you while you're doing it. So they come into a new relationship to new values through that experience. And for them, that may be a very positive development, that they're moved out of their self-centeredness into human generosity. And in a way, that's a valid experience, because that's what that inner Christ figure has been saying to people all along. So by entering the church, they are incorporating new parts of their psyche, and the function of that church has been to give people those parts of their psyche. This is why churches stabilize civilizations. Well, that's fine, but suppose it's their job to write a book. That Christ in the church is never going to say to them, write that book. It will only be the Christ in a dream that gives them their specific, personal, individual task. So, going to the church gives you some aspect of the, going into the institution gives you some aspect of the experience, and yet deprives you of other aspects of the experience. It gives you what that experience generally means. It doesn't give you what that experience personally means. And that is what he is trying to do by saying, oh, this is really what the church describes as this, and this is really what the church describes as this, and this is really what the church describes as this. It is true. That is what the church is. It has been offering, and it takes the burden of his own personal experience off of him, but it also takes the opportunity for hearing the individual message in that personal experience. I remember once I talked to a transactional analysis training group here, and every time I'd say something, they'd say, oh, well, that's the parent. Oh, well, that's the nourishing parent. Or, oh, that's the... And I wanted to say, actually, no, it's not. You know, they're experiences. But they could separate themselves from the experience by giving it a label, by giving it a pigeonhole, and still get some basic meaning out of what I was saying, but that was not the experience of their parent or of their soul or of their nourishing side. And I think that's what's going on here also. It's the beauty and the danger of the church, of any religious system. Yeah.
Quick question. When I was in college at IU, I led Bible studies for University Christian Fellowship. I love the material. And it was the approach, what do you think Jesus would say to you in your life? These analysis best heard contract difficulties. What is Christ? I like that because to me it was freeing. What do you analyze? You like the chapter? What's the best verse for you? But it allowed, I liked it because I've always been an individual, allowed some freedom for the person to say, well, I feel I need to work on this, and somebody else could say, I like that because that offered freedom. Does that make sense?
Yes. To be a bit of a devil's advocate,
I
would say I believe that priest fellow would have agreed. The priest guy I told you about.
Oh, okay.
But it took a dream to show him what Christ really wanted of him.
Yeah, right.
And then he wasn't so happy with it.
Well, we can get lost and project our own material.
Yeah, I think that's the danger of... of that approach. Given, you know, I'm always torn when I talk about this stuff, because given the awful nature of our daily life, where it's so self-centered, and we're just getting more and more criminal, it just amazes me what we do and it doesn't bother us. The church sometimes seems pretty good, because at least it's talking about an experience to make people decent. But I think for some folks, that experience, for some folks, that gives them a value, and for some folks, it actually robs them of a value. Because what in the Catholic guy, what that dream wanted that priest to do, really, which is impossible, is to start a priesthood of as a married man. And then you couldn't. There's just no way to do that. You could say, well, become an Episcopal. He loved the Roman Catholic Church. And, you know, I don't fault him for that.
But there are some churches that offer more freedom. We're friends currently. I like the friends because they offer. We have a lot of divergent people
yeah.
in the group. And which often causes probably our pastor trouble. But I like the free thinking.
Yeah.
But it has less rules. Of course, one of the rules is you're supposed to be think the way the rest of the group does. I mean, they always have their underlying, you know, if you were
yeah.
a first born Quaker and all this other jazz, why didn't I realize my mother was Quaker? And I resented that for years. I realized my mother died when I was a kid. So I dug out the materials. Well, I'm a first born Quaker. Well, I have a lot of fun going back and being the elder brother. But every church does. But I think there are some, to me, seeing grace. And if you can be free, I can be free in the friends meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the only one of five extrovert Italian people in my ministry. What I'm ministering to Mama do with you, but I really love you because you're free, freer than a lot of people. I like what they can, some churches I'm saying can offer
yeah.
acceptance in defense.
That's fine. I have to talk to people who can't find that meaningful, so what do I say to them?
Well, my analysis has helped me a lot.
Bringing it back to this, maybe we should just not try to push on another chapter, but sit with where we are. We've gone up through chapter 4. What we got into was how dogma both carries the unconscious in a way and inhibits an individual relationship to the unconscious. And this will be, we'll see him now going through several different attempts to deal with his experience. He's going to get elated. He'll try to get dogmatic. He gets preachy. He gets depressed. All sorts of things he's going to try to go through to cope with this experience. And I think we've got one more chapter of just description of wisdom, and then in chapter 6 we'll see him start to try to come to grips with the experience.
Is his experience that different from only more dramatic than what every person goes through?
Well, it's, you know, what is beautiful, I think, about the book is his experience is really modern.
Mm-hmm.
But his worldview had no room for it. Mm-hmm. That's the collision.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've said, you can look at this in two ways. You can say, oh, this is about his sex problem. Or you can say this is about the church's sex problem. And I would take it the latter, that what we see in him is an attempt of theology to broaden itself through one individual. And certainly we've made great progress, but certainly we have great progress yet to make.
So that would be Sophia in the historical sense.
That would be she made her first real foray into our tradition in this era, I think, to him. And then, of course, the other place she appears is, speaking of the Grail, in the Arthurian romances with the tradition of courtly love. Same kind of deal. And there you see the guy would go on a task for his lady. If you translate it as a metaphor, the feminine experience is meant to lead to an action. The experience of concupiscentia is meant to reorient our life. So you're pretty comfortable with the basic ideas? Sophia, instinctual and spiritual, shows up in matter, shows up in the body, shows up in desire. And it is threatening to that age, it is still threatening to our age, because she disorients things and wants to give us a new set of values. I do feel very strongly that she is the task of our age, and I was happy to hear Sandy say they did a conference 10 years ago where they said she is the archetype of the new millennium. And I feel also very strongly in seeing this in my work over the years, there is a new point of view being generated in the unconscious to prepare us for the next challenges. Why this is so relevant? I think those challenges started on September 11th. That's the beginning of the new millennium. A new world has started. New challenges are put to us. And a point of view to deal with them is inside us. And that is Sophia. And our job is to try to make that conscious and make our shift towards what she represents. That's why it's historically important as well. Thoughts? Questions?
I thought it started December 7th, 1941.
Well, we won that one. I don't think we're going to win this one.
Could this be at all somewhat similar to the midlife crisis?
You could say our America's in its midlife crisis. Yeah.
Collectively and individually.
Decline and fall. I hope, you know, I like Toynbee's work, that each era gives a civilization a challenge on which its decline or its renewal will occur. And I think we're at that crossroads. I'm not convinced that it has to be a fall, but it could be if we don't respond to this challenge. And this is now, I think, you can put Jung's work in a new light in its historical perspective, why it's so very important. I don't think he even knew why he was doing it, but this is its intent. September 9th. See you at St. Paul's. Thanks.
Have a good summer.
Have a good summer. See you in September. Well, let's see. We're going to get through the next chapter very quickly. I'd say read the first parable. We got all summer. I don't quite know how fast we'll go when we get to this next section. We'll slow down a bit compared to what we've done today, but probably not as slow as for where we started. We took a lot of time to put the groundwork down. Yeah, the first parable. Through the first parable.